You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 17th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Annette Gordon-Reed on the enormous significance of Juneteenth, which is this Saturday. Meanwhile, President Biden and Russian President Putin have wrapped up their summit in Geneva, with both coming to an agreement on an extension of the START arms treaty for another 5 years, and Putin dodged U.S. reporters' questions on the jailing of political opponent Alexei Navalny, fairly standard. As Biden is occupied in Europe, hopes for a large infrastructure package dwindle a bit as 11 Republicans reportedly back the much smaller bipartisan infrastructure deal, potentially clearing the threshold for the filibuster and making it less likely that centrist Democrats like Manchin will back a big reconciliation bill. But if progressive lawmakers like Bernie Sanders and Ed Markey hold the line and play hardball, there's still a shot. The Supreme Court has shot down the GOP's third challenge to the Affordable Care Act, with Amy Coney Barrett writing for the majority. Who would have thunk it? The Delta variant of the coronavirus is spreading rapidly in states, people believe, lagging behind in vaccinations, with Missouri being hit especially hard right now. A Harvard University report finds that more than 8 million households face foreclosure or eviction as certain CDC protections expire on June 30th. Mostly people of color will be affected. Hillary Clinton endorses Nina Turner's opponent in the Ohio 11th District congressional race. And then Nina Turner had her largest fundraising day ever. It must be a coincidence. And lastly, Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts urges Biden to back a resolution McGovern introduced to end crippling sanctions on Venezuela as poverty rates skyrocket. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out today, obviously, but we've got a great show for you. I'm pretty much filling in most Thursdays these days. Get excited. I'm going to go off the rails. Probably not. But we're going to have a little bit of Biden talk at the start of the show because he said some outrageous things, at the very least, ignorant statements, but he's the president of the United States, so you can't necessarily give him that leeway. So President Biden, he's been in Europe attending the G7 summit and then meeting with Russian President Putin, as I mentioned earlier. So foreign policy has got to be on his brain a little bit. But I'm not sure if he missed a massive chapter in his American history textbook, you know, the one that they give to every president, the one that Donald Trump kind of used as a footstool or something like that. There's not actually a textbook, but maybe there should be. So I'm not sure if he missed that chapter or seemingly conveniently forgot about it, but he made a pretty stunning statement about the nature of U.S. foreign policy in the context of admonishing Russia and Putin for essentially, you know, interfering in the U.S. election. Let's take a listen.
His credibility worldwide shrinks. Let's get this straight. How would it be if the United States were viewed by the rest of the world as interfering with the elections directly of other countries and everybody knew it? What would it be like if we engaged in activities that he is engaged in? It diminishes the standing of a country that is desperately trying to make sure it maintains its standing as a major world power. And so it's not just what I do. It's what the actions that other countries take, in this case Russia, that are contrary to international norms. It's the price they pay. They are not able to dictate what happens in the world. There are other nations of significant consequence, i.e. the United States of America.
Mainly us, yeah. Mainly
Wait
us.
Wait a minute. Mainly. Pause. Hit the pause button. Something's wrong.
I mean, I think maybe perhaps your focus when you make those statements, Biden is us. It's if he was conscious of it, or maybe he's not.
He so is. Biden knows. He's been a senator for.
Yeah. So I'm almost giving him too much credit there. If he wasn't conscious of it, I would say it's projection. But really what it is lying. Because, dude, we get it. Your role is essentially to cheerlead for the American empire, that entire project. That's what has defined your foreign policy for the many decades that you've been in power and been a senator, etc. But this is as ahistoric as it gets. So just some examples for the audience. The CIA interfered in the Italian elections post-World War II, discrediting the communist movement there and funding opposition to that movement for many years. And just essentially all of Latin America, the United States interfered in those elections, funding death squads in El Salvador under Reagan to crush leftist political movements. Same thing in Nicaragua, killing tens of thousands of civilians, contributing to a child soldier problem there, aiding in massive human rights violations. We even recently, we backed a coup in Venezuela, Honduras in 2009.
Lava Jato, Brazil.
Right, Brazil. Haiti in the early 2000s as well. So
which is not to mention all the times, like, it's not politics we intervene in, but like helping activists get murdered. I would just point out a quote. Actually, sorry, finish what you were saying there, Emma.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead, Matt.
I have this quote from Ben Rhodes, a much younger part of the Obama administration, but he got in hot water because this was in the context of the Iran deal and tried to make it look like he was like mesmerizing people into supporting that. But his point is, I think, true, and what this sort of these type of Democrats operate under. He says, "All these newspapers used to have forum bureaus. Now they don't. They call us to explain to them what's happening in Moscow and Cairo. Most of the outlets are reporting on the world events from Washington. The average reporter we talk to is 27 years old, and their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns." Like, that's why, like, that's what they think about the people that they're delivering messages to. But I also want to play a game with you, Emma and Brendan. Pick a year, because it is hard to like just list off all U.S. intervention, but pick a year between 1800 and the year 2000, and let's see. This is probably a non-conclusive or exhaustive list, but just give me a year.
Brendan, why don't you go first?
I'm going to go with a safe bet and say 51.
1951. Okay. So, yeah. Well, it was only three. Well, we're also in the Korean Peninsula, obviously, at that time. But in 1953, CIA overthrows government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. So, good one. Emma, how was about yours?
Ron, that's a good one. Good year to pick, Brendan. That was a fairly significant overthrow.
Maybe do the 1800s.
I was about to say 1871.
1871. Okay, we'll just zoom back here. 1871, forces landed in Korea. Okay, and just to give a little bit more, in 1870, Marines landed in Colombia. And so, yeah, we've been around.
To say the least.
And conclusively, I'd say more than Russia is actively right now. I think Russia absolutely interferes in other countries' elections, but I think America, when Joe said, they have to remember there's other countries, they have to remember we want to do that exclusively. We want the monopoly on that activity.
No doubt. And that's also matched by the perception internationally. So there was a poll conducted by the Alliance of Democracies Foundation. They surveyed over 50,000 respondents in over 50 countries. And the United States was perceived by people who aren't, you know, just Americans and aren't seeped and soaked in American exceptionalism like Biden has been throughout his entire career. The U.S. is perceived as a much bigger threat to democracy in general than both Russia and China. And based on the rules of imperialism and based on history, as Matt points out, and global hegemony, they're right. I mean, what's probably at the forefront of most people's minds, too, if you're just generally talking about U.S. foreign policy, has been the war on terror and what we did in Iraq, the offensive war that we started. So, of course, globally, that's going to be the perception, yeah, because it matches with the reality.
That's a good point about the war on terror, because you look at the way that has been used domestically in all sorts of countries against the left, and absolutely, like, you don't need to, like, assassinate a somebody on the ballot to consider it, you know, election interference.
Right. You can fund the opposition and give them arms and give them resources, which is what we do almost as easily as breathing. Joe Biden is actively lying when he says something like that. But it's a way that politicians kind of compartmentalize things. And it's much easier to present Russia as this adversary that does these things uniquely when it's one of the breads and butters, multiple breads and butters of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's a test of the media. Like, I mean, this is what a president of the United States of America is going to say almost in all cases. Like, even Bernie would have said stuff we would have found revolting had he won, I think, unfortunately. But as for the press, like, I think have some backbone, because I don't think... I think actually at different times there'd been more indignancy from, like, say, like the print media. That are you do you think we're idiots?
Well, I mean, that was I mean, that was the hysteria around the Russian interference, which did happen, but it's that's why it was entirely disproportionate. I mean, and that's what bothered me about the whole conversation, even though, as I say, I'm not denying that it happened, because there was attempted Russian interference in the election in 2016. But the fact that there was, it wasn't contextualized, that this is a part of the United States' playbook and this is what happened here, that's what frustrated me more than anything. And so now we're seeing it again in, like, okay, there's going to be zip response to what Biden said here. But hopefully we got context.
And just, like, one final note, the new way is going to be like the Lavajato thing, where you basically support regimes that want to do lawfare and make up scandals against left-wing politicians. That's going to be, I mean, they also will probably do a lot of plenty of the sort of CIA, you know, dark side stuff too. I imagine that's not over. We're not done with that part of our history, but it is, like, Lavajato, I think, is the model.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be listening to a pre-recorded interview by Sam with Annette Gordon-Reed on Juneteenth, our newest federal holiday. We'll be right back.
But first, we got an ad today that I have been the sponsor of, and it is Geology, which is a men's skincare reinvented product. And it is a simple skincare routine formulated for daily use. You know, I've really enjoyed it. It's a personalized skincare routine where you take like a 30-second test and then they tell you what you need in order to achieve that perfect skin you've been wanting for so long. And I would say, like, you can subscribe and get the whole package, or you can go a la carte. And at this point, I'm definitely going with the nourishing eye cream. It's been really nice, and I've seen, like, you know, the bags under my eyes since I wake up early for this show. They've been there, gone. And you know, a little bit about the nourishing eye cream. It just received the Best of Grooming Award for Ask Men, for the which is now the fifth award they've received for the eye cream. It's a dermatologist designed, and it's the best-selling product. So, you know, I guess I know something about good skincare quality stuff. And you know, you get great customer service, skin consultation. They'll help you walk through if this is new to you, if you're a little scared. They're very helpful. And you know, if you go to Geology now, you can save up to 40% off your 30-day trial, and click the link that we have in the podcast and in the YouTube description. Make sure to click that, because that's how they know that our customers really want that wonderful, glowing, beautiful skin.
Well, I will say, I mean, I am intrigued by the product. I went on their website, and it seems like they also have skincare for women, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Looks good.
Yeah, so
really nice website. Check it out.
I'm all about trying new skin products, so I'm excited about that. All right. Is that all we got for ads?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So now I bring you Sam Seder. I don't know if anybody's familiar with him, his interview with Annette Gordon-Reed.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the Zoom. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Carl M. Loeb University professor at Harvard University, Annette Gordon Reed, and author of her latest on Juneteenth. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with a fairly basic and remedial question. Juneteenth. Tell folks what it celebrates.
Juneteenth commemorates June 19th, 1865, when United States Army General Gordon Granger went to Galveston, Texas, to make the announcement that slavery was over in Texas and that enslaved people were then supposed to occupy a position of absolute equality with the people who formerly enslaved them. So it was the end of slavery in Texas.
And it also represented the last place in the country that slavery was ended. Yes?
Well, no, because here's the twist. Slavery legally ended in December, at the end of December, 1865, when the 13th Amendment was ratified. What this really is marks the end of sort of organized hostilities. The Confederate Army, the Army of the Trans-Mississippi, had kept fighting after Lee surrendered in April, and they didn't give up until the beginning of June. And it wasn't until then that Granger was able to go in and, based on the Emancipation Proclamation, because they could take control of the territory, make the announcement that slavery in Texas was over. There, you know, Delaware still had, you know, slavery that didn't end until, as I said, December 31st, 1865, with the ratification of the 13th Amendment. But this was the end of the Confederacy's armed effort to maintain the system of slavery.
And we should say your book is part history, part memoir. You yourself were raised in Texas and have quite a story. But let's go back to the beginnings of Texas. I mean, the interesting thing that I found in reading your book was Texas is in many respects a there's a lot of parallels between Texas and the country.
Yes.
At large. But let's start with the first slaves that were in Texas when it was not even quite, I guess, Mexico. We're talking the 1500s at this point. Tell us about Esteban Benico.
Esteban Benico, who's a person that I first heard of in maybe fourth or seventh grade. I don't remember which one, Texas history, but he was only mentioned in passing. He was an enslaved man who came with the Spanish explorers, among them Cabeza de Vaca. That would be the name that most people would have heard of. To originally going to Florida, they were in Cuba for a time and ended up crossing the Gulf of Mexico after their ship was lost in a raft and landing near Galveston, Texas, on the coast of Texas. And, you know, Estebanico was a person. He was had been a Muslim who had been forced to convert to Christianity and came with these explorers. And during this ordeal where they dwindled down to basically four guys walking across Texas and being enslaved by indigenous people for some time, escaping from them, he served as a translator as they moved across the land. He apparently had a talent for languages and was an integral part of this this dwindled expedition. He ended up being killed by Native Americans, unfortunately, but it was a very different story, very different introduction to, I think, to slavery or to understanding about Blacks in North America by looking at Estebanico as opposed to Jamestown, 1619. This is a century before then. Right. And there were people of African descent, others, not just Estebanico, who came to the area that was Texas, well, Spanish territory that would be Texas and Mexico, well before we think of the 20 people who were brought to Jamestown. And in St. Augustine in Florida, a similar pattern with Spanish explorers who brought enslaved people from Africa to the shores of North America.
And what really is, I think, you know, stunning in many respects is how much Texas's origins were not Caucasian.
Yes.
And how much are, and I guess, you know, I'm thinking of Westerns.
Uh-huh.
The perception of Texas is super Caucasian. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I was raised, you know, John Wayne and that sort of like perception. But in fact, walk us through how, you know, the relationship, how Texas became essentially was part of the westward expansion and how it gained its independence from Mexico.
Well, there were people from settlers, Anglo settlers in Texas who were coming over from Mississippi and Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia for, you know, for a long time. And they brought enslaved people with them. But these were little pockets of people coming. Stephen F. Austin, who is considered the father of Texas, actually his father himself, Moses Austin, got the right to land, to parcel out to settlers who wanted to come to Texas. And these people brought enslaved people with them. So that's how slavery comes into Texas, through Stephen F. Austin and the settlers who, the 300, I think, is the, you know, the number of people. There are more than that, more or less than that. But they came with enslaved people from the Deep South. So this is in the 1820s, before Texas, certainly long before Texas is a state. At some point when the Mexicans break away from the Spanish, they have the idea that they're going to outlaw slavery, and which they do. They kind of look the other way for what's going on in the province of Texas, because they wanted settlers to come because they wanted to have them sort of as a buffer or a bulwark against the Comanche and Apache, who were going in the territory and who were claiming land at the same time. So, you know, slavery was a part of it. When the Texians, as they were called, broke away from Mexico, they wrote a constitution that, unlike the American Constitution, explicitly talks about slavery and supports it. And it also talks about the fact that people of African descent could not be citizens of Texas. So it's, you know, the American Constitution talks about persons held to service. They invent some sort of, you know, discomfort with this idea, but this is no holds barred. This is a slaveholder's republic. And that's how it's in the document itself. That's how Texas began. And I should also say, they copied the American Declaration of Independence in lots of ways, but they took out the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." They skip over that part, the part that we think is, you know, we consider to be America's creed, and which people all over the world have looked to. They removed it. So that gives you a sense of what the state, the new, I should say, republic was about.
And we should say, I mean, it's fascinating to me that the Mexicans were sort of engaging in their own, I guess, colonial project against indigenous folks there, but using almost like outsourcing that to and many of these were farmers. I mean, when they were coming with their slaves to work, obviously for you know, primarily agricultural reasons. Like what were their crops at that point? I mean, were they just basically trying to transfer the tobacco, or, I mean, excuse me, the cotton, or was there other notions there? And I'm curious as to sort of the terrain and the opportunity there for agriculture. I mean, I guess I'm trying to get at is like, the value of their slaves to them was integral to their ability in their minds to make a lot of money.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Stephen F. Austin, who styled himself as anti-slavery, not because he, you know, cared about, you know, the humanity of Black people, but because he was discomforted by the thought of lots of Black people and that the population that would be required in order to maintain the slave system. So he was somewhat ambivalent about it. But he also said that if people came to Texas without slavery, large numbers of people, they could expect to be poor for a very long time. They understood that this labor system was integral to what they wanted to create in Texas. This is in the 1820s. We're beginning to see, you know, the cotton start to take off, become an incredibly important crop. And they wanted to extend the cotton empire into East Texas. And that's, you know, the most populous part of the state. We think about Texas in terms of the West and a desert. And people think, well, you know, where are you going to get cotton there? And, you know, sugarcane, too, was the other crop that they cultivated. So this was supposed to be about the expanding cotton empire. And they're explicit about that and understood that the people who came really wanted to make sure that their property rights would be protected while they were there. And so that, as I said, was the impetus for creating a constitution, made it a constitutional matter that slavery would be accepted and that free blacks would not be allowed unless they had permission to stay there. And that wasn't going to happen. I mean, right. It's a very clear sort of a racial hierarchy that's recognized in the state and slavery protected.
Where was that level of dedication to slavery? Was that where could we see that in other at least states or province, I guess, you know, or territories at that time? Or, you know, was that rivaled by any other state?
Well, you know, the Deep South, I mean, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, all of those places had, you know, plantation slavery and expectation. People had legal property rights in enslaved people. What's unique about the Texas situation is that, the other colonies, the 13 colonies, all had slavery, right, at some levels. Not all were slave societies, but they were kind of, I don't want to say, I mean, sheepish about it, but they tried to hide what they were doing, or they described this as a necessary evil. And that was the sort of thought. But here, it's much more open and, as I said, explicit. So I can't say that just because they didn't talk about it in the same way that they weren't as committed to it. I mean, because, I mean, Georgia and all those places right. were committed, sure. right, and they went to war about this. You know, but Texas, you know, it created a problem. Anytime something is new, right, and a new republic, before it gets to be a state, certainly it was controversial as a state. There were a number of northern states who did not want Texas to be a part of the Union because it was a slave state. But during its republic phase, it was, you know, looked down upon in some ways. Even their trading partners were somewhat put off by the explicit nature of it as a slaveholder's republic.
Speak to the relationship between, you know, the Anglos and the Hispanics that were, you know, there at the founding as well. Like, what was that when the Texas Republic became a republic? Like, what was the relationship between those who were maybe maintained some measure of allegiance to Mexico or identified more with Mexico as opposed to those Anglos who had come from the southern states with their slaves?
Well, I mean, it started out, as I said, as a mutually, you know, beneficial, they thought, relationship. But once they got the republic, there were efforts to move Tejanos out of the Republic of Texas. I mean, obviously there were people who were entrenched and who were part of the place, but it changed because they really wanted a government, a state that was basically Anglo. So things shifted. They became much less tolerant of people of Mexican descent in the Republic of Texas. And that's been a theme. I don't talk about it as much because I don't go, you know, into the 20th century and the, you know, some of the, well, I mean, there were problems all along, but suffice it to say that the kind of system of cooperation that had existed before ceased or came to a halt, really, once the Texians got their republic.
So let's, through those, I guess, those 30 years, the, you know, Texas, we get to when Gordon Granger came to announce abolish slavery. Talk about, I mean, you mentioned it briefly, but he also included in that a very called for the equality of personal rights and rights of property between the former masters and slaves. I was really struck by, he didn't say masters and former slaves. It was like there was a loss of status from those masters that weren't just a question of, tell us how that was received.
Well, it was received poorly. The whole thing was received poorly. There was celebration on the part of enslaved people, obviously, but there were instances when people who celebrated were whipped or were punished for celebrating. It was a time of violence against the freedmen. There are stories about, you know, bodies in the rivers, you know, as the river flowing, bodies would be in it. And Eric Foner's book, Reconstruction, talks about a scene where people describe coming into a village and seeing almost 30 bodies hanging from trees, men, women, and children. The whites unleashed a torrent of violence on the freed people. And so there was this combination of hopefulness at the same time as hostility, because you can imagine if you're right. used to being able to own people and then someone takes that right away from you, they responded with trying to impose control to try to bring things back as near to slavery as possible without the legalized aspect of it. And that was a campaign of terror in many instances.
What was the trajectory there? I mean, because we have some southern states where the violence starts, 15, 20 years, sometimes 25 years into Reconstruction or towards the end of Reconstruction, I should say, when you've got, established like a black polity and power. What was the trajectory in Texas through Reconstruction and into Jim Crow?
Well, you know, the violence was there from the very, very beginning. There are anecdotes about people in Virginia and other places when someone didn't take their hat off, they get shot. I mean, this is so the violence started early on, but it sort of escalates when you begin to see black people exercise the franchise, black men, because they were the only people who could, right. men could vote, exercise the franchise, hold office, those kinds of things. And voting became a sticking point for all of this, because that's about equal citizenship and exercising equal citizenship. And the idea of this notion of Negro rule, which the Dunning School of history in the early part of the 20th century put forward, that this was some tragic time and as a way of justifying the violence that went along with people exercising their rights.
And so we have the rise of Jim Crow, which is a response to that phenomena and coming out of Reconstruction. Give us a sense of what happens as we enter into the beginning of the 20th century in terms of like the violence continues to escalate there. I mean, as we add into that peak of like a renewed KKK in the country, mm-hmm. where is Texas? And at what point do we start to see Juneteenth celebrations and how are they received? Mm-hmm. Are they received differently? Because I mean, as a kid growing up in the 70s, I guess, I didn't hear much about it. Now, granted, it's up in Massachusetts, but yeah. I didn't hear much about it. Uh-huh. And it's, you know, you write that you were surprised to find out that it was a holiday celebrated outside of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it consistently celebrated through those years in Texas? Were there times where there was more concern about being public in the celebration through these years?
You know, they started celebrating it right after Granger makes his announcement. The Freedmen's Bureau, when it's established, has celebrations in the late 1860s. Sometimes it was about instructing people about voting, how to vote, you know, what the procedures were and so forth. But they celebrated certainly in their homes, in their communities. A number of them were at churches. In the 1870s, 1876, four men in Houston pool their resources and buy land to have a place where people can come to celebrate. And that land became Emancipation Park, which is still in Houston, which I have been to. And so, yeah, from even in the face of the kind of hostility, people celebrated it. And I sort of speculate in my book, I wonder if some of the celebrations in churches were done to try to forestall, with the hope maybe of forestalling, you know, violence here. But this is considered to be the longest running continuous celebration of emancipation, of an act of emancipation in the country's history.
Why do you think it was that moment that became, commemorated as opposed to, I don't know, the passage of the 13th Amendment or of the, you know, the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation? Why that one?
It's an interesting question, because I think Texans proselytized for it as they left Texas and went other places. They took the holiday with them and they talked about it. It's, I think, Juneteenth is a fun word. It sounds silly, but there's a whole industry that talks about trying to find the right word to describe things, to brand something. Juneteenth has that. It's a nice sounding thing. It's a fun sounding thing. It is in the summer. And it is sort of clearly a family oriented kind of holiday, a holiday about coming together. And it has caught on. I was surprised, as I said, when I learned that people celebrated it. But I think in the last 2 years, in particular, last year, there was a huge spike in interest in the story. And I have heard, and I think that this might be, other people have posited that it was around the George Floyd situation, that, you know, this is around the same time. And here, that got people to thinking about race and the predicament of African Americans in the United States. And then you have this holiday that comes up that talks about the end of slavery and why was there slavery and what are the legacies of slavery. So I think those things got melded together, and social media, you know, the capacity to talk about it, to make those kinds of connections. And I, you know, people who do this have been saying that, following this, are saying that there was a huge spike in searches about Juneteenth during this time period. So it's been steadily building, but the last two or three years, particularly last year, it was just a flood of interest in the holiday.
Yeah, I don't think I remember hearing, you know, much about it as such a institution even 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah,
frankly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine also the close proximity to July 4th, the theme of independence, you know, has something to do with it. But were there competing holidays at any point, if you're aware of? I mean, I'm always curious as
you mean, to competing emancipation holidays.
Yes. Other holidays that just simply did not have the resilience that Juneteenth did. I mean, people evangelized it coming out of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other that you're aware of, other emancipation holidays that just were not as, I guess, resilient?
Well, you mentioned some of them. Emancipation Day, January 1st, in connection with the Emancipation Proclamation. But even saying that, you understand what the problem is with that. January 1st is a big holiday in its own right.
Yes.
In its own right. So, and December 31st is not much better because it's New Year's Eve. It's a holiday. I mean, if we were to fixate on one of those, you'd be setting up a situation where people were continually disappointed because there would always be a distraction. People would be thinking about other things, New Year's Eve, Kwanzaa, New Year's Day, all of that. And I'm told that in Boston, they do celebrate Emancipation Day on January 1st. That I don't know that it's a state holiday, but that's another candidate for a possible a national holiday. I don't know that anybody's thought of making that a national holiday, but that is a competing holiday. And I think the problem is that they were situated around other pivotal points, New Year's and New Year's Day and New Year's Eve, the end of the year and the beginning of the year. And that that creates a conflict right there, and why I don't think that they've taken on the same, you know, they don't have the same cachet of June 19th, which is in the summer.
Right.
And it's a perfect day for family get-togethers, travel, the weather's good. There's just a lot to commend it.
And where has Juneteenth been officially recognized?
It's a state holiday in Texas. And I think all but about three states have some form of proclamation, some form of recognition of it. They're not full. I don't think they're all full state holidays where people get off, but there's recognition of it in most states. And a lot of corporations, my own school, Harvard University now, gives people the day off. I mean, school is not in session, but for staff and faculty and other people, the day is off. And so it's growing in the private sector as well. It's being recognized as a holiday.
I just want to turn for a couple of moments to your youth in Texas, because mm-hmm. your story of your schooling mm-hmm. and what was happening in Texas. Tell that story of how you, the circumstances in which you became, I guess, I don't know how you became the first to integrate your school as mm-hmm. as a young child. I mean, but describe, that scenario, why your parents, what your parents' thinking was and what, that experience in general.
Uh-huh. Well, this is about 10 years after Brown, and school districts in Texas and around the country were trying to find ways around Brown to not have to comply with it. And they came up with something called the Freedom of Choice Plan. And the idea was that white parents would pick white schools for their kids and black parents would pick black schools. My parents decided to do something different with me. I had gone to the black school in our town, Booker T. Washington, for kindergarten. But I was about to start first grade, and they decided that they would send me to Anderson Elementary School, which was a white school. My two older brothers, who were sort of in the middle of elementary school at Booker T. Washington, remained in those schools. But because I was starting, you know, sort of real school, I guess they would have thought that they would send me there. And I have to say that their thinking, their explanation for why they did this kind of changed over time. It was portrayed in later years as a kind of pragmatic thing. Oh, we knew that the court was going to strike down freedom of choice plans, and we wanted you in place when this happened. My father talked about the fact that white schools were divided by age. There was elementary school, you know, intermediate, junior high, high school. And he thought, well, there must be something to that if that's what they're doing. And we're in this K-12 situation and you're with older kids and blah, blah, blah. That's why we sent you. I think from remembering the time, from what I was able to glean as a kid at the time, I think that their ideals, that they were more idealistic. I mean, they were in the middle of, if you think of the times, this is you know, around the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, there was a spirit of the times. And I think that they were flowing with that spirit of the times. As they became, I guess I would say, more disillusioned about the effects of integration, they changed the reason for why they did it. And it became a pragmatic decision more than idealism. But I think that they were idealistic in this, that they were part of a movement. And this was an example of that. And that's why they decided to send me to Anderson.
Well, from, describe that experience. I mean, you know, separate from your parents, you know, sort of, I guess, aspirations for what that would mean, that it sounds like, you know, over time, maybe weren't necessarily fulfilled. Uh-huh. But from your experience, I mean, what was the experience like for you?
Well, it was, I would say, a tough time in some ways. My mother said at one point I broke out in hives. So you probably think that that might have been stress related in a way. My teacher, Mrs. Daughtry, my first grade teacher, Mrs. Daughtry, my second grade teacher, Mrs. Gilliland. Those are the sort of two formative, you know, teachers in periods when I was there. Were fantastic. I don't think they could have handled things better. And they made me feel completely at home. I never got any sense that I was treated any differently than anyone else. I say in the book, I was a good student, so I made things easy for them, and I'm a pretty even-tempered person. So I wasn't a problem, you know? And so from that, on that front, things were easier. And I loved to learn. I love to read. You know, my mother had put a lot into, you know, teaching me and so forth. My mother, the teacher, had been doing that even before I got there. So the actual academic part of it was thrilling to me, and I enjoyed it. And so that's what made it, you know, a happy place. School was a happy place for me. Now, some of the kids were nice and some of them weren't nice. So I learned through that process that not all white people were the same. But, you know, I also had a sense of being, because I was on display, various delegations of teachers or educators would come and stand in the door and sort of look in to see how this was going, how this experiment was going. And, you know, I knew why they were there. And that was something you don't know anything different, right? I mean, I'd never, not been in first grade before without that. So I figured, okay, I know why they're there, and I'm on display here because this is a strange situation. I've done something that's different. And I did have that sense very early on of being on display, having people and it sort of translated over the years or transpired over the years that people knew who I was, but I didn't know who they were.
Right.
And sometimes people were hostile because they knew who I was, and sometimes they were not. But a lot of times I can recall people being, you know, hostile towards me. And this was in some situations, Black children who resented the fact that I had, what they thought, started this process. And when the court struck down freedom of choice plans, they all had to change schools. And I kind of got blamed for that. I was a symbol of that. And people would be hostile to me, want to fight me. And I didn't even know who they were. You know, it was this bewildering kind of situation to be the object of people's scorn when you didn't know who they were. Now, I knew why, but there's something about not knowing a person who wants to fight you and you don't know who they are was interesting.
I would imagine. And the concept that you were somehow responsible for the court case.
Well, these are kids, you know, gets mashed together.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. And do you have a sense, I mean, maybe relative to your brothers, like what that did for your perception of how much of Texas was wrapped up in, how much of Texas was, you know, sort of a white heritage versus a black heritage?
I think what it did was to make me think about why this situation existed. What was the big deal about having a black child go to school with white people? Why was this? Why were we in this at this space? Why is it when we went to the doctor, there was a waiting room for black people and a waiting room for white people? And the waiting room for white people was much better appointed, much larger and spacious and nice. And ours was, you know, functional. And, you know, sometimes we, you know, had to stand outside because it was not enough room for everybody. You know, what was that about? And when we went to the movie, we had to sit in the balcony. So I think it had awakened in me thoughts about race, the question of race. And certainly it was exacerbated when I went to the school, the clinics and all those kinds of things. That was a part of daily life even before I went to Anderson. So I knew that even before I got to Anderson, I understood that black people and white people, that black people were treated differently than white people. But the experience in Anderson made me made me analytical about it, I guess I would say, thinking, why? What is this all about?
Interesting. And I have to just also note that it's fascinating to me that freedom of choice was used in that era to segregate students in some respect. And it sort of made a comeback in some of the the charter movement and the privatization movement and that type of thing, and vouchers. But really fascinating. And I should ask you, since we're pre-recording this, how will you be celebrating Juneteenth this year?
Well, I'll be talking. I'll be doing programs is what I'll be doing. And I'll probably try to find some red soda water to drink. I won't barbecue. I live in an apartment. So that's not that's out. Maybe we'll purchase some. I mean, that's what we typically do. We try to have some commemoration of it in that way. But but for the most part, I will be talking about Juneteenth on Juneteenth.
Annette Gordon-Reed, the book is On Juneteenth. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
We are back. We should note that the Juneteenth has become a federal holiday as of yesterday. This interview was pre-recorded and it really was excellent. But before we run out of time, I want to get into this Andrew Yang situation, this from the debate last night. So last night, the New York mayoral candidates debated ahead of the June 22nd ranked choice primary, and Andrew Yang stood out as particularly vicious. Here's a quick taste of his rhetoric about New York's most vulnerable.
Matt, can you stop sharing your sound?
Yes, mentally ill people have rights, but you know who else have rights? We do. The people and families of the city. We have the right to walk the street and not fear for our safety because a mentally ill person is going to lash out at us.
Ah, so that's just a 10-second clip. He goes on a much longer rant later, but homeless people distinctly othered in that statement. We have rights. They are mentally ill. They're scary. And his proposal is essentially to institutionalize them through forced commitment against their will. But he didn't stop there.
The fact is, mentally ill homeless men are changing the character of our neighborhoods. A woman, my wife Evelyn is friends with in her mom group in Hell's Kitchen, was punched in the face by a mentally ill man. Sent a picture of a bruised face around the mom group, spread like wildfire. This is happening in New York City, and we're not talking enough about it. Families are leaving as a result. In East Harlem, the neighborhood has been changed. Upper West Side, the neighborhood has been changed. We owe our people and our families better than this. And I'm frustrated by the political nature of these responses. I mean, we're not talking about housing affordability. We're talking about the hundreds of mentally ill people we all see around us every day on the streets and the subways. We need to get them off of our streets and our subways into a better environment. And when you ask what I'm going to do differently, I'm going to rebuild the stock of psych beds in our city, because the number's gone down 14%. It should be going up 100% until there are resources necessary for anyone who's mentally ill to not be on our streets. It's not right for them. It's not right for our city. There will be no recovery until we resolve this. I will fix this, New York.
Thank you, Mr. Yang.
That is the greatest non-answer I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, Stringer then goes after, oh, how are you going to pay for it? Which is great, great line of attack there. But there's so much there. This rhetoric should not come as a shock, because Andrew Yang just 2 days ago was endorsed by the NYPD Captains Union. This is who is funding his campaign as well, or who's running it at the very least, has ties to the police union. He's one of the two candidates in the race who will not defund the police or cut their budget in any way. The other one's Eric Adams. So he's leaning into what they want to hear. And Yang's UBI plan, which isn't a UBI, saps resources from homeless services and then gives stipends for once a year checks, and you'd have to forego government services in order to receive it. So it's actually libertarian garbage, but it comes back to his resentment towards homeless people. And what he equates there is real New Yorkers. Homeless people, they're not real New Yorkers. They're absolute horror for wealthy New Yorkers to have to look at homeless people. He equates that to their human dignity. And there is something really insidious behind his rhetoric here. It was really disturbing to watch. And it goes to show that when you're running a libertarian-ish kind of right-wing campaign under the guise of progressivism, this is really what's beneath the surface. But as the people who are funding his campaign have said proudly, he doesn't really have any political core. He's kind of an empty vessel. I think that was the quote. And now it's been filled with garbage, law and order, dehumanizing garbage that would affect people in our most vulnerable population, institutionalize them against their will, and I don't think it's even constitutional, let alone it's absolutely disgusting. But that's our show for today. We have to say goodbye to our Peacock audience. See you on Friday tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around,
it's nice to see Yang just take the lane that he's so obviously wants to be in, and not this like, oh, I'm actually left like Bernie Sanders. Like, no.
Yeah. It's refreshing in a way.
Yeah. No, show your true colors, dude. Exactly. So I'm calling into the phones now. Looking forward to taking your calls. We'll take some IMs. What a beautiful noise. What a sound. Do we have Matt?
He should be joining momentarily.
Yeah, but that's the thing is that's because, one, we didn't have that many ads today, and we started on time. So, like, look at that, you know, right before 1 o'clock. What's different about the show as to when we, you know, when we started? It's just, it's hard for me to figure out.
We may never know. That's the best.
Well, he picks the call up every time. He's just yesterday too.
I wish I could just send him like a three-way call of the ones I get. I could just bring him on as me, basically, and have him go.
All right, shall we head into the fun half?
Yes. We don't have Binder yet, but Binder will be able to plug at the end. So I'm going to go now. But I just want to plug quick.
Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Matt.
Lance from the Serfs will be joining David Griscom and I on Left Reckoning tonight to talk about the Kamloops boarding school gravesite discovery and how we should probably expect more similar discoveries and the dark legacy of boarding schools in Canada, and we'll probably touch on also in America. And we'll also probably talk about, well, that's the main headline for tonight. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to access the post game. And that will be on the YouTube page, which everyone should subscribe to. We're close to 11,000, subscribers. And so go subscribe to that, folks, Left Reckoning on YouTube. And, here's Binder now. All right. Just in the nick of time. I was trying to stall there. Hey, Matt. He'll be joining. Matt Binder, welcome to the show.
Matt Binder.
Welcome.
I'm here. Just getting my camera on, and there we go. Hello, wow. Guys.
Nice haircut.
Why, thank you. You know, it's the summer season approaching. Needed to free my head of the heat. So I thought I'd. What was that?
Lighten it up, like lighten your. You know, it's
right.
Long hair is tough in the summer.
Right. Yeah, and this, you know, this is my first long hair summer, and the I've never noticed before how hot the back of your head gets, just like existing in a room. So I've been doing a lot of man buns, I guess. Because you got to air that, you got to get some airflow back there. Otherwise, you just build up excess heat right underneath your cranium.
Right. And for me personally, I get, you know, once my head gets to a certain length, it just starts to, you know, curl a little bit, get split ends. So you need to always just freshen it up and just start anew. So the nice new hair grows in. So, you know, I will grow it long again, but I just need to do this every now and then. You know what I mean?
Interesting. It's cyclical.
Yeah.
Right. I like that. Yeah.
So what's happening on Doomed, Binder?
Well, tonight I will have Jared Holt on the show. You know, Jared Holt, formerly of Right Wing Watch. Now he's with Atlantic Council. We are going to talk about, basically, there's been a lot of talk, mostly spurred by this article that claimed that QAnon is dead. And unfortunately, while we would love for that to be true, it is not. Right. In fact, just to give you guys a little taste of what we'll be talking about, the current biggest QAnon influencer is an anonymous individual who goes by the name Ghost Ezra. He or she or they have a Telegram channel that has around 300,000 subscribers, and they are quickly, very quickly, going from the usual QAnon conspiracies to straight up Nazi anti-Semitic talk, like straight up like Daily Stormer status.
Right.
And so, you know, you have this, and 300,000 QAnon believers are on this channel. To give you an example of how bad that is, the open Nazi white supremacist anti-Semitic channels, the biggest one probably has about 10,000 subscribers. So QAnon is quickly becoming a pipeline to even further right stuff. That will be tonight.
Who would have thought?
Right. YouTube.com/Matt Binder, 9 p.m. Eastern time.
All right. 646-257-3920. See you in the phone.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457-238. 56, 27, one half, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.